The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
People, meaning that we're not living in monasteries. And one of the... It's not uncommon for people who are living lives of lay practitioners to sometimes wish they had more opportunities to practice. You know, maybe I should go off and be a monastic. Maybe I should go off and spend a year at a monastery or a few months at a monastery, and so I can really get into the practice and really, you know, have no distractions, nothing in the way, so I can just practice, and somehow it'll all become great. Oh, some of you have tried that? No better? And so the difference between a monastic life or a full-time life at a Buddhist center and lay life is not that great. A lot of it has to do with the intention, the support, to really give yourself over to the practice more often. So in a monastery, you're just reminded more often, and you're around people who are interested in that, and so you kind of mirror each other and get a sense, oh yeah, pay attention now, or be compassionate, or show up and be here. Oh yeah, meditate, that's a good idea. But a lot of it has to do with intention and how much we actually kind of pay attention to the moments of what we're doing. So I'd like to offer you one little principle that can turn lay life, dedicated practice in lay life, into something that's as valuable as spending time in a Buddhist monastery or Buddhist meditation center for extended periods. And that's the principle called attention to detail. Just that, attention to detail. To pay attention to the details of what's happening to you right here and now. Not living in an abstract world of stories about the future, stories about the past. Not living in an abstract world about kind of concepts about people or concepts about yourself. But to learn to pay attention to what's happening right here and now and what's needed right now. When I practice at the San Francisco Zen Center, one of the little mottos they had about practice was, what's the request of the moment? What's being requested of you in this moment? And the way that they sometimes explain this would be that if you are, in your kitchen and you're kind of looking around seeing what's going on, and so what's the request of the moment? What's being asked now? What's the attention to detail? There are dirty dishes in the sink. And then you'd go over and you'd clean the dishes. And then as you put the plates in the dishwashing machine or put the, do whatever you do with those dirty dishes, the request of the moment, attention to detail, would be, how should they go into the rack in the dishwashing machine? You know, should they go in carefully? Should they just go haphazardly? Is there a particular place where that place feels like it? That's the place for that plate. Where's a place for that plate so it's in harmony with what you're trying to do? Maybe there's a lot of dishes, and so you have to kind of put them in such a place so you can get a lot of things in there. Attention to detail. It can seem like a much too mundane thing, much too unsophisticated for people who are serious practitioners of the Dharma. And if you really want to get into the Dharma, you forget about the dishes and where the dishes go into a rack. That's ridiculous. You know, anybody can do that. I'm going to go and get my big, fat book on Buddhist philosophy. That's where the Dharma really is. And so you just came in from out walking in the rain, and your boots are muddy. And so you have that philosophy book. I have to get that. And so you walk across your living room floor on the carpet with your muddy shoes. And then you get your great philosophy book and you put your dirty feet shoes up onto the coffee table. Or even better, you swing it up on the white couch so you can really kind of be there for that experience and really get into the philosophy of the Dharma. And so a lot's missing. You're not paying attention to what's going on. And what's the situation you're in now? What's required? What's going on now? I think there's a Jewish story of someone who was really into reading the sacred Jewish texts, and the person's baby was crying in another room, and the rabbi came by and said, "What's going on here? You're studying, you know, the sacred texts and not taking care of the baby? Oh, I didn't notice." Attention to detail. What's the request of the moment? What's happening now? What needs you right now? The philosophy book or the baby? So the attention to detail. The first time that I saw this in my Buddhist practice was when I was about 20 years old. I went to the Los Angeles Zen Center to go and meditate with them. And they had did two sessions of meditation, and then they had a 10-minute period of walking meditation in between. And then you walk in a single file around the room, perimeter of the room, kind of everyone walking at the same pace, very stately, and almost like a ritual. And I was walking right behind this woman, and we were walking by all these black mats, you know, zabutons that people are sitting on, like I'm sitting on here. And there's a whole bunch of them all around there. Everyone sat on one, all in neat rows. And there was one up ahead that was slightly out of alignment. I was 20 years old. I was a hippie. So. And to my surprise, the woman in front of me, when she came up to that mat, she bent down and straightened it out. And I was like flabbergasted. Why would she do that? And I don't know if it went through my mind, but it could have gone through my mind, well, that's pretty anal. Or you know, that's pretty, you know, uptight, wanting things just to be just right. But it was an example of attention to detail. This in a Zen meditation hall, there's something very nice about having things all lined up neatly. And it creates a certain context and a certain kind of engagement with the mind, with presence, with being here. And so she was a caretaker of that, and she lined it up. Another attention to detail that also had a big impression on me was when I sat the 7 days Zen retreat. On the first day of the retreat, in the mid-afternoon, they come with a tray and hand out to everyone a beautiful little ceramic, maybe handmade ceramic, teacup. And then every afternoon they come and serve silently tea mid-afternoon so we can be refreshed for more sitting through the afternoon. They usually come with a tea and a cookie. So they'd serve tea and you drink silently and then you continue with your meditation. And we'd keep our cup for the 7 days right next to our seat. So one of these sesshins retreats, I was sitting next to a visiting Zen monk from Japan. And he sat very well, very, very present. And the last day of the retreat, they came with the trays to collect all our cups we'd used for the week. Take them away, we didn't need them anymore. We had tea and they came and collected them. So we had a little teas right in front of us, sitting cross-legged in meditation posture, and they came around to collect them. And when it was his turn to return the teacup, he bowed to the teacup. What? A teacup? Bow to a teacup? That's ridiculous. But I was so impressed that he had a certain attention to detail. He had appreciated the teacup. The teacup counted. It was important somehow. And so he expressed his appreciation, his gratitude, or there was some kind of like attention to detail. Well, just that cup. You know, whereas I kind of would just toss it on, you know. Another thing then, Zen, This expression, attention to detail, is one of the mottos that characterizes the school of Zen that I studied in. So in Japan, they had, I would go and in the monastery, sometimes I'd carry the rice pot from the kitchen to the dining room. And and if I carried it with one hand, I would be reprimanded. You always had to carry with two hands. And so in Zen, this characteristic of you don't do things casually, you give yourself to what you're doing, attention to detail. So, you know, if you pick up a teacup in the monastery, you wouldn't just kind of like pick it up and keep talking and just, try to speak while you're drinking or something. You would actually pick it up with two hands and lift it up, and with two hands you would drink. Now, it's not an ethical thing to drink tea or water with one hand. It's not like you're a bad person because you do it casually. But in the monastery, it's a training of how to really be present for the details of the moment, for this moment. And to really not to be present for it casually, but to be present for it as if this is the most important thing at the moment. And we don't just do that with an idea, we do that with our whole body. Just this. Be here with this. Putting the plate into the rack of the washing machine, as if that's the most important thing in the moment. Just this. How do you do this? Be there for that. And this was a big training for me in the monastery, because I was often, I had all these attitudes about what I was doing. Like, get over it as quickly as I could and rush through it. Or it wasn't really that important. You know, I had more important things to not only do, but I had more important things to think about. And so I wasn't really paying so much attention to what I was doing in the moment or what I was... and sometimes I didn't like what I was doing. And so if I didn't like what I was doing, then I would pull away or do it half-heartedly or something like that. But the training was to do everything wholeheartedly, to attention to detail, be really there for this particular detail of what you're doing at the moment. And this idea of doing it with two hands was a way of really training us to give ourselves to this experience, this moment, what's happening now. So in terms of it being training, Buddhist training, like mindfulness training and stuff, it has a lot of benefits. One of the benefits is it begins to train us to be in the moment with our experience. And that's what we're trying to do in meditation, to be in the moment with our experience, to not let the mind carry us away into the past, the future, into fantasy and thoughts, but to really kind of attention to detail in meditation, just here with this breath, just here with this experience of the body, just this moment here. So it's a training, and so it supports this whole process of learning to be present more fully here and now. The second thing it does is that it begins to show you all the ways in which you are not so present, all the ways in which you don't offer attention to detail. And some of it might be reasonable, that you're not supposed to pay attention to detail every single moment of your life. It's a little bit oppressive. But by having this practice of attention to detail, this moment, just this, it's a time to notice what your mind is doing. Notice that your mind is not very interested in being present with what's happening now. That your mind is racing ahead. It's concerned about the meeting tomorrow. And so you got to see, oh, the meeting tomorrow, I'm really caught up in that. Is that what I want to do? You get to see that the resistance we have to what we're doing. Sometimes we get to notice that maybe we're not so wholehearted. We're kind of dragging. There's all these things. We like something, we don't like something. We're for it, we're not for it. And so we can start seeing that, and it becomes kind of a chance for us to choose consciously, intentionally, how do I want to be right now? Do I want to be present for this moment of my life? Or do I want to miss it? Do I want to be off, more important things to worry about than this moment? Are there more important things to remember than be here in this moment? And the hope, I think, my hope is that more often than not, if you ask yourself that question, you will say at this moment, the most useful, important thing I can do is to be here fully for this experience, this person, this thing that I'm doing now. Because there's something about that comes alive in this moment. There's something that we see clearly, becomes three-dimensional, our world. And there's a momentum or kind of opening, unfolding that happens if we start doing this more and more in our life. That we have access to more and more of who we are in the present moment. If we're not in the present moment with experience, even with the dishes in the dishwashing rack, you're also not going to be present for yourself. Because chances are, when you're casually doing the dishes and not paying attention too much to it, your mind is far away, and not, you know, far away from yourself to hear. And even if you're far away and you're thinking about yourself, chances are that the way you're thinking about yourself is abstract, is general. And part of the training in attention to detail is to learn to break through the enchantment or break through the spell of generalizations. Overcome the strong tendency to see ourselves and the world around us and other people through abstract general concepts of things. Attention to detail interpersonally means what's really happening now? What's happening? Who is this person? So you might decide this person's a jerk. Certainly. So then the question, attention to detail. Jerk is just a gross generalization, abstract concept. What's the detail? What's actually happening here? What's actually happening is the person is struggling for 3 days with a migraine and doesn't have the resources and the ability to somehow be polite or kind or give you the time of day. And they're not, you know, a jerk. They're someone who's struggling with their migraine. That's the details of the moment. So to ask, what's really happening here? What's the details? What's the details with which we build up the generalizations? So always going back to the detail. What's actually happening? What's happening? What's happening? So attention to detail, to make a habit of it, to keep looking back at it. Now, it could seem that this is really simplistic. It's not inspiring, like great Buddhist teachings on emptiness or great experiences of compassion or wonderful experience of deep samadhi. But in Buddhism, this is the foundation for all of Buddhist practice, is attention to the details of the moment. And it's like the building block or the foundation point we build everything up. And to give you one example of this, of how we want to keep coming, Buddhist practice all comes back to being in the details of the moment. So much of it is the emphasis on the particular detail of the moment, which is the feeling tone of experience. If you go back to the teachings of the Buddha, you find that he over and over and over again emphasized how important it is to be in your direct experience. In your direct experience, attention to detail of this moment, how it is. So in the direct experience, and within the direct experience, how are things directly sensed, felt, and experienced? The direct details of it. And so if you go into an experience that's uncomfortable, then the direct experience, the feeling tone of it is the discomfort. And there's very often we react to the discomfort or the comfort, the pleasantness or the unpleasantness of the situation, independent of the story and the event of what's going on to it. It's kind of like the amoeba-like reaction that we have. And so if we can stay right there in the detail of the moment and see, oh, that's an uncomfortable situation, I don't have to react to the discomfort. I don't have to pull back from it. or this is a pleasant situation, I don't have to lean into it. Many situations we're in become much easier. It kind of loosens up how we are with the situation, much more wisdom. So by being in the present moment, attention to detail, what's happening right now? So for the Buddha, this thing about the pleasant, unpleasantness, and neutrality of any experience at all is one of those little details that is kind of like the foundation. It's like the genesis of so much of the abstract world we have. Some people think that great philosophies and political philosophies had the genesis in someone who was uncomfortable with something. And they wanted to justify getting rid of it. And so it got more and more sophisticated, you know, or they tried to be at least. So attention to detail. Buddhism, it's all in the details. So do you have any questions? Or you want to ask for any details?
It'll keep you happy.
Yes, it will keep you happy. Oh. Yes, Sylvie.
Thank you. This was very interesting. What I was wondering is, in this attention to detail, you spoke about one side, which is, or how I interpreted or understood it, that it's really kind of an inward focus, attention to detail. And I was wondering if you can comment on how you would cultivate this same attention to detail and practice it in the context of interpersonal relationships. So imagine you're speaking to someone and you're trying to really understand. I don't feel you're paying attention to detail. like, take this opportunity. When you look at me like this, I can't think.
Oh. I look at a different detail.
How would you use it to try to, for example, understand where or how they are suffering, or, you know, an unmet need that they would have, or how would you apply this or use this opportunity to practice?
I think the interpersonal attention and detail is very important. That's what I said about, you know, the abstract. We have abstract judgments about persons, situations, but we don't really know the details. And so sometimes we have to learn the details to really know what's going on. And sometimes it's not so useful to judge the person because that's abstract and we miss the details, but rather we can judge maybe the particular activity. But then we're into more of the details, and what's motivated that activity? What's the source of it? What's the context for it? So some of it involves asking questions and having ability to ask good questions. What's really going on here, and what's the context for this, and how's this person feeling right now, and you know, what's the background of that person that I don't understand, that I should understand? And some of that has to do with history with them, some of it if you know them. Now I know I'm not supposed to look at you in a certain way. I'm just joking a little bit. Sometimes you can ask the person. Sometimes it's really good to ask, you know, what's going on? You know, how are you really? Or can you tell me more? Just very simple. You don't want to often probe, you know. But you can ask simple questions to find out more what's going on rather than. And then picking up all the cues, you know, there's lots of cues, you know, the facial expressions, posture, how they sit, how they look at you, tone of voice. And there's all kinds of ways you pick up some of the, what's going on more in detail. That's, you know, not obvious if we're not really present to see. Does that make some sense? Is that enough, or you want to say more?
No, it's enough. It seems like it's kind of the same opportunity. Basically, to it's not just inward. You can take that opportunity in every conversation. So,
yeah, this is where the what's the request of the moment? What's asked for in the moment? And sometimes in the moment, what's asked for is to pay a little bit more attention to the other person or the situation or the dishes. And sometimes, you know, it's not the dishes, but the baby that's crying. The dishes are piling up, but something else is needed. Our relative is sick, and we need their attention. Other times, what's needed is to pay attention to ourselves. So I go into the kitchen one more time, and there are dirty dishes, and they're piled up. And why doesn't my partner ever do the dishes? And I'm furious. Attention to detail then, what's the request of the moment? I think the request of the moment is, I better sit and breathe and really kind of look at my anger and try to cool down before my partner comes home. So then we can sit down calmly and have a conversation about the dishes. So sometimes internally, sometimes externally, you know. And then when my partner comes home, this is an attention to detail. Here's a story when I used to work at Green's Restaurant many years ago in San Francisco. And there was, I was a cook. So there was a place where the staff, the cooks and waiters, would go upstairs to a kind of locker room kind of area where we would change into our, you know, white cook's uniforms and, you know, staff area. And so one day there was a change of shifts and I was getting ready to leave and someone else was coming in. And it was a friend of mine. And he came in, came up the stairs and walked in. And I was happy to see my friend, delighted to see him. And I immediately engaged in some light-hearted banter, kind of just affectionate kind of banter. And only to find out that one of his best friends had just died that morning. And so, you know, I missed, you know, and I don't think I caused too much harm, but it was kind of, what was requested in the moment was not to joke around with my friend. And I didn't take the time. As soon as I saw him, I immediately went into this kind of banter. I didn't take the attention to detail. It means, notice who you're with first. You know, probably the signs were all over his face. But I didn't stop and pay attention. Okay, thank you. Yes.
The what's required in the moment, in my head, there's often 74 things that are required at the moment. And I have difficulty with choosing. Have you any recommendations about that?
Oh. So I would find most interesting is to pay attention to the mind that's holding 74 things. What's that mind like?
It's a mess.
So now you have 75 things to pay attention to. But I think the mind that's holding it is probably the most important detail. That's the real thing that's happening right now. Those 74 other things are probably a little bit abstract compared to that. That's the filter through which all those other things are going on. So I think it's really important to spend some time with the mind then and settle that mind.
Because, I mean, I think certainly there are practical situations when the doorbell's ringing, the dog's just peed on the floor, the pot's overboiling, and the kid's crying when you do have to choose. And those are practical, unavoidable things.
Right.
But I think what I'm talking about is less of a practical nature. It's just work pressures, that kind of thing.
So I think then even more, I think take a look at that messy, you called it a messy mind. I think that's what needs your attention. And to take an honest, good look and to be with your messy mind, not to analyze or understand it, but kind of like offer the kind of presence to it that you would with a friend who is really frazzled. You know, you don't suddenly like, tell me what's going on, you now. Let's get into the details. A frazzled friend, you want to just kind of be with them, offer them tea, make space for them, maybe go for a little walk with them. So offer your mind that kind of presence and attention. And maybe help it to settle and relax. So you start seeing what's going on. And especially until you can try to seeing, is there a common denominator to those 74 concerns? And the chances are there's a common denominator, a root for them all, that's driving all of them. Anxiety, worry, might be a good one.
Thank you.
Yes, Stephanie.
Hello. Thank you very much for that. In doing this practice, I have been watching my mind a lot. And one of the things I've learned recently is that I was getting caught in watching. And my mind was playing tricks on me, and I was believing feelings that turned out to actually be aversion. So I'd have a feeling, and it wouldn't last very long, but I would believe the story about the feeling, and then I would keep re-upping that.
So,
and then I would feel like I was having a feeling for like days, and actually the initial feeling was just for a few seconds. And then the story behind the feeling went on for days.
Perfect. So this is why the Buddha emphasized feeling. How important it is to really be right there at the genesis of feeling and see how we react to it. And the Buddha claimed that there was a weak link between feeling and our reaction. Though most of us won't believe it's so weak. but there's a weak link there. If we can really be catch it right there at that genesis, that beginning, then it doesn't have to spin out into a story for a long time.
Yeah, and I was believing the initial feeling and actually going off with it and then thinking that I was meditating and then it would get bigger and bigger and bigger. And what I was actually meditating on was the aversion
to
the feeling.
And probably you were telling yourself more and more stories.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so now the way out of that cul-de-sac is to to see the feeling, to say, I have this feeling, and isn't it sad? To kind of sit next to it like a big sister.
Perfect.
Or like a mother and say, isn't it sad you have this really strong feeling?
Nice.
And that is the way out of that trap.
That's perfect.
Because if I just meditated on it and just watched it, it just grew and grew and
perfect.
Grew.
Perfect. I think it's it's a lot of wisdom. So that, a number of things I like what you said, but what I'll highlight right now is you learn from your experience. And sometimes it takes a while to learn, right? Days sometimes, you know, but eventually do it.
A few months.
At first it's a few months, then it's a few weeks, then it's a few days, then it's a few hours, then it's a few minutes, and then it's a few seconds. It gets better, but this is the wisdom you slowly acquired will help you. It's very nice.
Thank you.
Hi, Gil. Right here, back here.
Yes.
While I was listening to the examples you mentioned, I was just remembering the times in which I've been told, you take too much details, you take too much attention to details, you put too much attention to details. You are perfectionist. Is there a difference between putting attention to details and perfectionism?
I think so. What do you think?
To be honest with you, when you were describing some of the examples, that is me putting attention
to details,
aligning things, organizing things, cleaning things. My clothes is organized by color in my closet. But for some people, it is too much attention to details.
I don't know.
It's perfectionism.
I think it's, I don't know. It could be who you are. It's part of your gift. It's part of a wonderful way of being in the world. It's possible. But if you look at the bigger situation, part of the attention to detail is, do you have blinders on, or are you including everything that's going on? So if you have friends who feel uncomfortable coming to your house because they have to sit just properly and they can't move and can't breathe, you know, they put their teacup down and you go over and move it over.
No, but I have a partner who has attention disorder.
Uh-huh. So is your partner uncomfortable with what's happening?
Yes.
So then you need to have a conversation, and maybe attention to detail for you includes the detail of your partner's situation. And so to really have things lined up really well at your house with your partner, things have to be a little bit more chaotic than you. And there has to be some compromise sometimes. And hopefully your partner compromises and straightens things up a little bit more than would otherwise. And you are a little bit realizing that for you, you have to be, you keep doing exactly what you're doing, attention to detail, But now it has to include the attention to how keeping things just a little bit messy. Just the right way.
Thank you. I'll try.
So I see hand here, if you don't move it. Oh, please go ahead.
I have a question about, and I'd like to continue what the lady over there was talking about, this filter.
What?
This filter that yes. when we encounter people, and for me anyway, it's I see things through a filter, and often that filter is from a different time.
Yes.
And I think where I often get scared is that I don't know if I'm seeing reality or whether I'm reacting from something that happened long time ago. Mm-hmm. Where I got emotionally frozen or stuck or, and so I also have this tendency to build a story out of something that becomes epic, you know, in comparison to what's actually happening in the moment. Yeah. How is it possible to really see what's in front of you without the filter, and how do you get past that?
I see. It's a good, very good question. And sometimes it's not possible to not have the filter, but it's possible to know that you have a filter. And so you know that it's you have to take this with a grain of salt. You don't, can't quite believe the story. And so then you can see through the story. It's like a through the filter and see, try to understand what's really going on. And not kind of believe the filter, not automatically buy into it. So that's one thing that works sometimes. The other thing is something like meditation is meant to be one of the places where we drop all our filters. And then if you're able to get really calm and settled and drop all your stories when you meditate, then as you come out of meditation, pay attention to what it's like to come out of meditation and notice what it's like to walk around a little bit without any stories or filters or interpretations or ideas, and see how that's nice. See how that's satisfying or nurturing, and get a real sense of what that's like. Have a reference point of a fresh mind or clear seeing. And the more you have that reference point, the more quickly you'll catch your filters.
That's very useful. Thank you so much.
And then because it's such an important one, I'll offer you one more thing. And that is, don't just do it alone. If you have good friends that you can do this with, ask them. Tell them. I have this story going. I have this story from my past. I'm interpreting because of this way. Is this accurate, or what do you think of this? And sometimes being able to talk about it with someone else helps us see more clearly, and sometimes supports us to kind of break the bubble of the filters. Oh, no, it's not that way. So I see, one more. This man back there is trying.
Okay, thank you. I've been struggling with this for a while, the concept of multitasking, when to multitask, when not to.
Uh-huh.
As long as I'm aware that there is a choice, say, for example, sometimes I'm just pulling up little weeds, and I can make the choice, okay, go for the roots and just be kind of there, or think about some other things as you're just mindlessly doing this.
Yeah.
But one of the problems I'm having is I'm with people more and more, and I guess I'm one of the dinosaurs that does not have a smartphone by choice, because I'm with friends, whether we're on the golf course or whatever, and they're continually checking their email, and I'm finding myself getting aggravated, like, you know, what am I, chopped liver or something, which is an ego thing. Yeah. I realize that. So I find myself, the culture is really kind of intruding or can, and I realize it has to be a real conscious effort, when to really focus, when not. If I'm working with a radial arm saw, I better well focus on what I'm doing and not be daydreaming, or I'll lose a few fingers, and that sort of thing. I find a lot of, in dealing with children when we're doing algebra problems, really focus in step by step. What does this have to do with anything other than math? Well, someday you're going to be driving a car, and you better be focused on what you're doing, type of thing.
Yeah.
But it is a personal struggle for me, too, when to zero in, when to be tolerant of others.
Yeah, thank you. I can feel the the distress over this thing. It's shared with a lot of people, how society's changing and all this. And a few things just occurred to me, as you said. You said a lot, so I'm not sure where to pick it up exactly. But we have a society which maybe is becoming a little more, it looks like it's more attention deficit disorder is becoming a society characteristic, not individual, because people are jumping around so much. And some of it is just human nature. And so how do we work with that? So for you, how do you decide when to multitask and when not to? There's a time for multitasking, and there's a time to avoid it, and to do that consciously and to know it clearly. I remember when I was shocked, my first time I was kind of staying at the San Francisco Zen Center, and one of the senior priests, Philip Whalen, who was a famous poet, he was a priest there, and I came to breakfast, and at Zen Center, I had the attention detail meant just do one thing at a time. That was kind of like the motto. And he was eating breakfast and reading the newspaper. And so I asked him, how can you do that? You know, when you eat breakfast, just eat breakfast. And he said, no, when you eat breakfast and read the newspaper, just eat breakfast and read the newspaper. And then some years later when I worked at Greens as basically a fast order cook, I'd spent first 3 years in the monastery where the ability to do one thing at a time was really, you know, primo kind of situation for it. At the fast order cook, I couldn't do one thing at a time. You're supposed to do, I had to actually have many, many dishes up and cooking at the same time and spinning around and putting it out. And so then my practice was only do that. You know, just the dance of it. And I just would, the whole, you know, time would kind of stop. And there was no outside the restaurant. It was just the kitchen, spinning and doing many things at once. And that's what was called for, was to give myself over fully to it. And it was very joyful to do it, if I really gave myself fully over to it. It was multitasking in a sense. What to do about other people who are multitasking on their phones, when you're kind of like playing golf, you know, or whatever. I don't know. But I can tell you that I have this issue with my teenage sons now. You know, they used to be, when I was younger, they were happy when I came home. they would run and throw themselves up into my arms. And I think they've forgotten how. You know, it's like, hi. Do they know I'm here? And they're involved in all kinds of things. You know, certainly their devices, since they're, you know, whatever they're doing, they're involved. And so what I've learned with home is it can't be on my time that we have a connection. I just wait until, in the course of things, they're ready to talk or they're ready to connect. And then I make sure that I'm available. So for your golf friends, just you be available. Be very forgiving, very allowing, and just notice when the few moments arise that you can make a real heart-to-heart connection and try to make the connection richer. So they're probably not going to be checking on their phones after they hit the golf ball and they're watching it go up in the air and seeing how far it goes. Be right there with them. And when it lands, turn to them and say, that was great. You know, how'd you do that? Or that must feel really good. So just look for the opportunities where you can and just kind of be patient with. Good luck. So all kinds of details. And what's the request of the moment? What's the request of the moment that meets the moment with compassion, love, and peace? Thank you.